From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We begin with the inside story of an historic scoop. 40 years ago this weekend, March 16, 1968, U.S. soldiers entered the South Vietnamese village of My Lai and killed hundreds of unarmed civilians in what became the most notorious atrocity of the war. Lieutenant William Calley Jr., a platoon leader in Charlie Company, was court-martialed and charged with murder. In 1971, his commanding officer, Captain Ernest Medina, spoke with Bob Schieffer of CBS News shortly after Calley was found guilty.
Why? You ask yourself, why My Lai? Why me? Why my company? You can go down outside this building on the street and take any young teenager that's walking down, average American, apple pie and mother. Those were the members of C Company. At times it doesn't seem real. It's like a dream.
While working on a book about Pentagon procurement, reporter Seymour Hersh received a tip from an anti-war attorney about a guy who shot up a bunch of civilians in Vietnam. At the Pentagon, he floated that tip by a general working for the Army Chief of Staff, and the general mentioned William Calley. Armed now with a name, Hersh tracked down Calley's lawyer, George Latimer, in Utah. There in Latimer's office, Hersh laid eyes on an Army indictment sheet charging Calley with the murder of, quote, 109 Oriental human beings.
By the way, as soon as I saw that document, I'd like to tell you, I thought, oh, my God, this is going to kill the war. It's going to hurt the war effort. But really, fame, fortune, glory raced through my mind. What a story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a great story. That gave me the big start, and I figured out where Calley was. I spent a horrible long day looking for him, finally found him.
You didn't know where he was?
Oh, my God, I didn't know anything. I just knew the charge sheet was written at an Army base in South Carolina, and I just started looking for him. I flew that night from the West Coast via Chicago, I think, into Columbia, South Carolina, rented a car, went to the base, and at that time they were open. I was waved in. I parked my car. There was a main headquarters. It was a 30, 40-mile complex. And initially, I went to every prison. There were four or five prisons. And I would just drive into the front, and I had my ratty old suit on and a tie and a briefcase and a rental car. I'd get out, and there'd be some sergeant. And I'd say, Sergeant, bring Calley out.
You were posing as a lawyer.
I didn't say. If anybody asked me, I always said I was a reporter. But if they made that assumption, that's fine. And, of course, Calley wasn't in any of these bases. And I'm driving from one camp to another. And I went back to the main headquarters. I'd gone to every sports club in the base and all the music clubs and everything, and I was sort of stuck. And then I remembered when I worked in the Pentagon as a correspondent, the phone books are changed every 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Calley had come back, according to the lawyer, in August. And here it was in October of 1969, I'm looking for him, and the phone book was dated September. When he came back, he hadn't been charged. He was under investigation. He was just a guy coming back. So I called up the information office of the base telephone service. I got the chief operator, and I asked her to check the new listings for the old phone book, the last wave of new listings in August, before the new book was published in September. And it took a long time, but they finally found a William L. Calley Jr. that was listed at an engineering base 20 miles away, another one of these large Army facilities. And I raced over to that base, and when I was in the Army, we lived in huts, but this was a concrete building with three floors and every bed beautifully made. And I ran around from one floor to another and couldn't see anybody. Finally, in the corner of one of the floors was a kid sleeping on a bunk, top bunk. And I thought, this must be Calley. And I remember kicking the bunk and waking up this blonde kid. And I said, wake up. And I said, Calley. He said, who? And I looked at him. His name was a Polish name. And he was sitting there, this very young 19-year-old, 20-year-old kid sitting there confused. And because we are nosy, I said, what are you doing here at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? And he said, I sort the mail. And I said, did you ever hear of a William Calley? And he looked at me and said, you mean the guy that shot up everybody? And eventually, he took me to another facility where there was the senior enlisted man in charge of the mail was there. And Calley wasn't there anymore, but he had told them what a great hero he was. And I got that story. And then they told me where he was. He was living, get this, the one place nobody would look for him, in the senior bachelor officer's quarters. We're talking about a place with a tennis court and a swimming pool. The last place you'd think, particularly somebody who'd been in the Army like me, a potentially criminal murder first lieutenant would be stashed, but he was stashed there. So I started walking through each room, knocking on doors, saying, hey, Bill Calley. I spent maybe 3 or 4 hours doing that with no luck. I left. It was dark by now, 9, 10 o'clock, and there was a guy working on his car. I was so exhausted, I was going to go to a motel and check in and wake up at 3 and knock on everybody's door again. And I went to that guy, and he was a warrant officer, and I said, "Callie?" And he pulled himself out from under the motor, and he looked at me, and he said, "You're looking for William Callie?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "He lives below me." And Callie was on a boat that day. He'd gone boating. When he came in to the barracks, I was waiting for him, and I said, "Are you Callie? I'm Hirsch." He said, "Oh, yeah, my lawyer said you'd look me up as if I found him so easily." This is 12, 13 hours of looking. And then he told me his story and pretended to be very cocky and calm. But at one point, it must have been 4 or 5 in the morning, we were drinking beer, and he went to the bathroom, and he left the door open and had a mirror in it. And I saw he vomited bright red arterial blood, which I knew then he had an ulcer probably as big as a quarter or a half dollar. And it was a pose.
Not only did you speak to Callie, but you spoke to other people who were at the scene who were very candid about what happened.
After I'd done the first story, I ran into this wonderful soldier. He's now dead, Ronald Reidenauer. There's a prize now given in his honor every year. Ronald Reidenauer was a soldier who learned about this right away and tried to get something done through the system without any success. And he gave me a company roster. And I began to find the kids. What happened is they had been in the country, this company, Charlie Company, for about 10 or 11 weeks. And they all had been told you're going to be fighting North Vietnamese regular army. They saw nobody. They were a 100-guy-strong company. They lost maybe 15 or 20 guys to snipers and bombs. And they were very angry, and they were beginning to take it out on the population. They were told March 15th, tomorrow morning, you're going to meet the enemy for once. You've been here for 3 months. You haven't seen a bad guy. Now you're going to see the bad guys. And they did what that army did then. They toked up with their joints, and the enlisted men and officers drank. But they got up at 3:30 to kill and be killed. You got to give them their due. They jumped on choppers. They go to this village. They march in looking scared to death, thinking they're going to be in a firefight. There's 500 people sitting around making breakfast, all women, old men, and children. No young men of fighting age. They gather them in three ditches. Callie orders his young men to start shooting. One was Paul Milo, and he shot and shot and shot. When they were all done, they sat along the ditch and had their lunch. Don't ask me how, why. And they heard a keening. And one of the mothers in the bottom of the ditch had tucked a boy underneath, a 2 or 3 year old boy. And he climbed up out of the bodies full of everybody else's blood and began to run in a panic. Callie said to Milo, Paul Milo, this kid from southern Indiana, "Plug him." Milo, one-on-one, couldn't do it, although he'd fired maybe 10 clips of 20 bullets each into the ditch. So Callie, with great daring do, took his carbine, ran behind the kid, and shot him in the back of the head. Everybody remembered that. The next morning, Milo, they're on patrol. Milo gets his leg blown off to the knee, and they call in a helicopter to take him out. And while he's waiting, he starts issuing an oath, a real oath, a chant. "God has punished me, Lieutenant Callie, and God is going to punish you. God has punished me." And the kids, when they finally began to tell me about it, and I didn't learn about this for 2 weeks, although everybody knew the story, when the one told me, they all told me. So I hear this story. He lives in southern Indiana. I just dial away, and I call every exchange in Indiana. Finally, New Goshen, Indiana, which is below Terre Haute, which is below Indianapolis, which is below Chicago. That's where he lives. I fly to Chicago, go to Terre Haute, get a car, go to New Goshen, spend hours. It's a chicken farm. Milo's back. It's a year and a half after the incident. He was shot. He's home now on this farm. Run down. Chickens all over the place. A shack house. This mother walks out. I introduce myself, my ratty suit again. I said I was a reporter. I wanted to talk to him. I knew what happened. She said, "Well, he's in there." She said, "I don't know if he'll talk to you." And then this woman, this old southern uneducated woman, she said to me, "I gave them a good boy, and they sent me back a murderer." I go see the kid. And the first thing I do is I spend 20 minutes talking about his leg. And then I said, "What happened?" He said, "I just began to kill people."
Another enormous story you broke much more recently was the prisoner abuses at Abu Ghraib. And some have drawn parallels between My Lai and Abu Ghraib. Do you think it's fair?
Yes and no. They weren't killing people. But I've talked to a lot of young officers, company commanders and platoon leaders, you know, first and second lieutenants. And the one thing you have in common is they couldn't stand their job because 95% of them was keeping kids from doing terrible things to the civilian population of Iraq. If you don't see the enemy and you're losing people through landmines, we had 5 Americans killed this week in an incident. The other soldiers, what are they going to do? They've lost 5 buddies. The rage toward the civilian population has got to be immense. I did, I think, 3 stories in 3 weeks for The New Yorker, which I will tell you is no fun. In between that, I'm doing shows, and I was on a NPR show, and a woman calls in and said I had a child in the unit.
At Abu Ghraib.
Yep. I gave her my phone number over the air. And she called a couple of days later. I go to see her, and she had a child come back, completely changed, was completely withdrawn. At some point, the woman who called me took the computer that the child had brought back and began to go through it, and there was a file marked Iraq. She hit a button, and out came 80 photographs. And the one that The New Yorker published was the iconic photograph of the naked man in front of bars, hands behind his head, two Belgian shepherds mm-hmm. snarling at his feet. Well, in the sequence that this woman, this mother saw, the dog attacked the man in a sensitive spot, blood all over.
So that was how you got those pictures?
Probably at that point, at the height of the Abu Ghraib crisis, this is the second week, could she have gotten $100,000 from a network for these pictures? Probably more. She just gave it. Six months later, I took her to dinner. I was giving a speech somewhere in the area, and she told me the following story. What she hadn't told me earlier is when the child came back, she moved out of the house, left her husband, left the family. Every weekend, she began to get tattoos, dark tattoos. Every time they saw her, more and more tattoos. Eventually, she filled up her body up to the neck with dark tattoos. And the woman said to me at one point, it was as if she had wanted to change her skin.
So there's the comparison. I'm just wondering, though, isn't remembering history supposed to prevent us from repeating it?
Are you suggesting that the American leadership learns from the past? I don't think there's much evidence for that. As we had hell to pay after Vietnam, we're going to have hell to pay among our own soldier population from this war. And that does not even begin to deal with the catastrophe that we've visited on Iraq and the Iraqi society and the Iraqi children who are now in the fifth, sixth year of this utter madness they've been growing up in, this psychotic madness. And what do we owe them?
Cy, thank you very much.
Goodbye, kiddo.
Seymour Hersh is the national security correspondent for The New Yorker.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last month, the president's 2009 budget request included $395 million to, quote, engage foreign audiences and win support for U.S. policy goals. This continues the Bush administration's trend of increased spending to influence hearts and minds abroad. Meanwhile, public opinion polls consistently show America's image abroad sinking to new lows. 23-year-old WashingtonPost.com correspondent Amar Bakshi has spent the past 8 months exploring the rest of the world's love-hate relationship with America for the Washington Post's foreign affairs blog, Post Global. His trip through Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and Latin America took him to nightclubs, sporting events, and mass protests to report on popular perceptions of the United States.
One problem that the United States has in terms of its public diplomacy efforts is it tries very hard to sell ideals that I think are already fairly popular, freedom, democracy, etc., but have been corrupted by actions, for example, supporting Saudi Arabia or the kind of debacle going on in Iraq. So more salesmanship, I don't think, is what the United States needs. But, you know, on the bright side, I think what Karen Hughes did quite well was radically increase the number of exchange programs that U.S. students had with other countries and encouraged even younger and younger elements of American society to go abroad. So there is some good use that spending is being put to. But I think we need to reconceive how we're doing public diplomacy so it's more about dialogue and less about branding and salesmanship.
You and others have broken down anti-Americanism into 4 basic categories. Can you run through them for me, please?
Sure. There's liberal, social, sovereign, and radical. Liberal is Americans don't live up to their own values. We support torture even though we say we don't. You hear this a lot in England. Social is Americans don't take care of their poor. They're too hyper-capitalist. And people will turn to Scandinavian democracies rather than American ones because they say there's a better social safety net. Sovereign is, you know, America's impinging upon our right to self-governance. You hear this from Zimbabwe to Venezuela as populist leaders try to drum up a foreign enemy to justify their strong rule. And then radical is the toughest one to define, but it's basically everything about America is antithetical to who you are and what you want to be. Islam is a cohesive way of life. America is too afraid of it, therefore it wages a war against Islam. And I think the shift from the first three towards that final one are what we should be watching and be worried about.
Now, Amar, this may sound like a ridiculously naive question considering what all has gone on for the last 7 or 8 years, but, you know, I am curious why so many Muslims around the world believe that America is at war with Islam itself. We are, after all, in bed with many Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, which practices an extremely conservative form of Wahhabi Islam, and we did dethrone Saddam Hussein, but we have installed a Shiite government fundamentally in his place. If this is a war against Islam, it's a pretty selective one, no?
It often falls to the advantage of local leaders to play that card to consolidate support. Then, you know, the media, small viral videos, websites, YouTube clips show horrific pictures of young Afghan boys getting their private parts blown up. They circulate like wild among a lot of websites, even YouTube, until they're taken down. And I think another reason is because they see America talking one thing and doing something in their eyes that looks very different. And so it opens up a lot of space for these alternate explanations.
You also encountered quite a bit of affection for the United States, even among people who criticize it.
I think it's our saving grace. What people always say is love, hate. And what they mean is love for sort of many of the ideals of Hollywood, what it represents. If you look at Pakistan, a man I interviewed who's a transvestite on national TV named Begum Nawazi Sali, has one of the biggest TV audiences in the country, grew up worshiping American pop culture, American rock and roll in the 80s, while her parents in the military were with Zia al-Haq, and she had to hide her fascination under the covers and, you know, read and listen to music late at night. But at the same time, she's livid at the policies that robbed her of a free childhood. You get this always, especially with the older generations. I think something to watch is with the younger generations, where there's a lot more cultural products to choose from, you get less of a love-hate relationship and more of the capacity to say the U.S. has done very little good for us at all.
So you've been around 10 countries, 4 continents, I guess. What was the most surprising thing that you encountered?
I was always surprised by how far into the middle of nowhere I could go and get very visceral reactions to the United States. You know, really rural Philippines, where a woman would say, I feel like I've been raped by America. Very graphic stuff. What I found quite amazing was how much of this was pegged on much longer swaths of history. In the Philippines, the presence of U.S. military bases and the narratives of U.S. soldiers, a few of them, unfortunately, raping Filipino girls, you know, and it's different in every country. So while poll numbers often make it look like, you know, it's all about Bush, the Iraq War, you know, certainly these things are true, but it was much more about catalyzing and crystallizing a whole variety of discontents that are very locally based. And unless we understand and start addressing them, we will risk just washing on top of a phenomenon and never really getting at its roots.
All right, Amar. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Amar Bakshi's recent project, How the World Sees America, was jointly published by The Washington Post and Newsweek Interactive's foreign affairs blog, Post Global. Some pictures of war are seared forever into our consciousness. The Nick Ut photo of the Vietnamese child Kim Phuc, burned and naked, running from a U.S. firebombing. Matthew Brady's ghostly Civil War tableaus, and not least, Robert Capa's powerful depiction of a Spanish Civil War soldier captured at the moment of his death. Capa took that photo and won his place in photography's pantheon when he was only 23, fully embedded on the front lines of the Spanish Civil War. It is the scene of a Republican soldier falling backward at the very instant he is struck by nationalist fire, and it sums up Capa's "You Are There" command of war photography. That 1936 image is also arguably the first globally iconic war photo, because the Spanish Civil War was the first to be photographed daily with the images distributed worldwide. Many of his pictures that were thought to be lost surfaced a decade ago in Mexico, and after much negotiation have finally been acquired by New York's International Center of Photography, In the aggregate, says the center's director, Willis Buzz Hartshorn, this Kappa cache represents a new opportunity to understand mass media image-making from its birthplace on the battlegrounds of the Spanish Civil War.
For the first time, you really have this kind of collective consciousness of history and what's going on, and you have people turning to the magazines to try to understand the things that they're hearing about on the radio or through news reports.
Now, I don't know about his predecessors in wartime photography. I do know that he himself was not a neutral observer of the Spanish Civil War. He was nakedly on the side of the Republicans, that is to say, the left-of-center government that was trying to put down a right-wing coup, and he was not shy about his sentiments.
Yeah, I think the simplest thing was he was an anti-fascist. And the importance of the Spanish Civil War was that it was really the last opportunity in which there was the feeling that one might be able to stem the tide of the rise of fascism. You know, you're talking about a man who was born in 1913 and at the age of 16 was thrust out of his hometown of Budapest, Hungary, for political leanings that were, you know, naive and student-like, who goes to Berlin and enrolls in university to study journalism and has to leave Berlin because of the rise of the Nazis, and he's Jewish, who goes then to Paris, and he turned to photography as a way of not only making a living but also a way of kind of understanding the world. So he's active in the world. He is personally buffeted around by these political events in a way that probably too many of us don't really understand or appreciate as that generation has moved on.
I think most of our listeners are well aware of Robert Capa's general fame in the pantheon of photographers, and especially wartime photographers. But they may also be familiar with him in another way and not even be aware of that. And I'm referring to the Alfred Hitchcock movie Rear Window, in which Jimmy Stewart's character was based on Robert Capa.
He and Ingrid Bergman were very close, and to be with her, he went to Hollywood and sort of kicked around there for a while and realized that, as the Jimmy Stewart character, realized that he kind of missed the travel and maybe even missed the danger, and that he wasn't going to be able to settle down.
Isn't it time you came home? I could get you a dozen assignments tomorrow, fashions, portraits. When I don't laugh, I could do it.
Well, that's what I'm afraid of. Can you see me driving down to the fashion salon in a Jeep, wearing combat boots and a three-day beard? Will that make a hit?
Well, I could see you looking very handsome and successful in a dark blue flannel suit.
Now, let's stop talking nonsense, shall we?
If you think of a photojournalist as a hard-living, fun-loving gambler with a cigarette dangling out of his mouth, with a camera slung over his shoulder, running to an airplane to go to some part of the world, that's Robert Capa. And that was Robert Capa, and that has become a kind of archetype for the photojournalist.
He not only invented that persona, he invented his own name. When he arrived in Paris, his name was not Robert Capa.
No, he was born Andre Friedman, and he moved to Paris and began trying to create a career for himself as a photographer. And he and his companion, Gerda Taro, who unfortunately had a very brief career and was run over by a tank and killed in 1939, covering the Spanish Civil War, he and Gerda were working together, and she was actually kind of his business manager, and she would go out and try to sell his pictures. And what they realized was that if they created an alter ego, if they might be able to sell Capa's pictures, Friedman's pictures, more effectively. So they created this American photographer, Robert Capa, who was highly successful, and Gerda would go to the various agencies and say, well, surely you must know the work of Robert Capa. He's one of the most famous American photographers ever, and, you know, here's an opportunity. It didn't take too long for the people in the photo agencies in France to realize that Andre Friedman and Robert Capa were the same thing. There's no indication that this helped him sell a single picture, but it did succeed in changing his name and added the sense of mystique and mystery about the man.
In no way to impugn his skills as a photographer or his courage or his storytelling ability or any of the other dimensions of his genius. Are you certain that this man who invented a name and invented a mythology and did such highly subjective reporting would be able to thrive under the contemporary understanding of journalistic objectivity?
There's a very small group of journalists working today, and I guess I would think of James Noctway and Gilles Perez and Susan Mizellis. They're photographers who are choosing their stories. They're able to choose their stories by basis of their stature. to bring our attention to those world events that they think cumulatively are the most important things for us to see. The opportunity for what I'm describing is greatly diminished today because of the lack of picture magazines, the rise of television, etc. And you have an extraordinary shift now where you have citizen journalists. You look at the bombings in London, and the pictures that we have of those bombings are cell phone videos that were taken by the people who were participants. And all of a sudden, there's a very different kind of relationship to photography and documentation and where the photographer and where the pictures sit relative to the action.
Well, Buzz, I appreciate it. Thank you.
My pleasure, Bob.
Willis Hartshorn is the director of the International Center of Photography. Novelist and journalist Jim Lewis used to believe that in wartime, graphic photographs were crucial to documenting atrocities. He himself had taken such photos in Congo. Then, in 2004, he changed his mind. The story of Fallujah had broken. Four American contractors had been murdered, and their bodies hanged from a bridge for all the world to see. Those images prompted Lewis to write a piece for Slate, arguing that graphic documentation of violence doesn't necessarily help anyone understand the story. I spoke with Lewis 4 years ago, but his ideas resonate with our program today.
Part of the problem with printing photographs like this is that they tend to strip away any of the context which would help anybody actually understand the story. You know, what did these guys look like before this happened? You know, what were they traveling in? What part of town were they in? How many people actually were there? All of that gets lost in the grisly sight of these bodies hanging from a bridge. I just think that to the extent that it's the function of journalism to explain things to people, photographs like this actually do less explaining than one might otherwise wish.
Your thinking on the subject changed based on your own work in Eastern Congo.
Mm-hmm.
You were there almost a year ago. Tell me about your experience.
I was based in a little town called Bunia, and we went out of town one day, myself and another reporter and a photographer, up into the hills outside of town where we had heard that there had been a massacre, and we got there, and there was. And there was nobody else there except for the people who had died, and they had been not just killed but dismembered and in a particularly horrific way. And after I had finished sort of taking my notes, and the people I was with had other work to do, and I didn't know what to do. And I was just kind of standing around and took out my camera and took a lot of photographs.
So what you had in your camera was something shocking, something extraordinary. At what point did you know that your mind had changed and that whatever these pictures were, they were not something to be shared with a mass audience?
I would be talking to friends and family and people that I worked with and trying to explain what was going on in the Congo and what I had seen, and I would show them these photographs along with others, and I just found that they got in the way of trying to tell the story I wanted to tell, and that, in fact, rather than clarifying the story, the shock of the photographs had a tendency to derail both my telling of the story and other people's understanding of it.
In your piece in Slate, you referred to a story where a man killed himself and that the suicide was captured by the security cameras in his building and then somehow found their way to an internet site that traded in shocking video footage and so forth. And the mother of the victim, I believe, was beside herself wondering how her son's death could turn into a sort of pornography.
What I mean by pornography is just that the fact that such a thing exists on film at all is often so surprising to people or so shocking or exciting or whatever it may be that it tends to overwhelm the information that the pictures would otherwise actually convey.
Now, I saw the Fallujah pictures when they were first published and aired, and they were genuinely horrifying. But I must say, I was not as moved by them as I was by a single line in a single Wire story about one of the kidnappings in Iraq. It was of a Jerusalem resident who evidently also has a United States driver's license. And the kidnappers, to prove that they had this guy in custody, were showing his passport and his U.S. driver's license and his supermarket frequent shoppers card. Mm-hmm. And the very quotidian nature of a supermarket frequent shoppers card was so humanizing for me that I got very choked up, far more than I did from the most graphic pictures emerging from the war.
I have much the same sort of reactions. I used to think that only a photograph can really accurately convey what goes on in a war, and that anything less than absolute explicitness would amount to a kind of whitewashing. And I think, in fact, that's simply not true. A well-written paragraph can be just as informative and just as horrifying and just as touching, but doesn't run the same kinds of risks.
Well, Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Lewis is a novelist. I spoke with him in 2004. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, tabloid fare was splashed on the front pages of the nation's great and not-so-great newspapers. Everyone in America now knows the name of Elliot Spitzer. But this convergence of high and low culture was already well underway. The April issue of The Atlantic features Britney Spears on its cover. The fallen pop star seems to be on every cover these days. That's why her every move is chronicled daily by a horde of some 40 photographers. But Atlantic readers and some bloggers have decried the decision to put her on the cover of so venerable a journal. The 10,000-word story inside is by reporter David Samuels, who defends the story and the cover. But he says he's very, very sorry to those who feel betrayed. David, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Yes, I want to take full responsibility for destroying the Atlantic, 150-year-old pillar of American journalism, and now it's gone, thanks to me.
Did you know you were so powerful?
No, but it's gratifying.
Don't you think that there is something to be said for the idea that celebrity coverage is now the province of everyone, everywhere, at any time?
Yes, that's true. At the same time, we know so little about where these pictures come from. You're talking about a business that's worth, at this point, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And the focus of my piece is an agency called X17, which is the biggest photo agency in Hollywood and has produced almost all the memorable shots of Britney Spears and many other celebrities. It was started by a guy named François Régis Navarre, who was the correspondent for the French newspaper Le Monde and for the AFP in Los Angeles, who actually covered the Rodney King trial and riots for AFP.
You know, it's fascinating that he came here to cover Rodney King, because that was a story that was put on America's cultural map by amateur photographers, people with no training, who were at the scene capturing some video. I wonder if this sparked the idea that he could train a cadre of just anybody to do it.
It didn't. It sparked the idea that he could make a living taking photographs in L.A., but that turned out to be wrong. He tried to do, you know, serious photojournalism about gangs of L.A. and this and that, and he found there was no market for it. But one day he took a picture of Rod Stewart, I think it was, at Fred Siegel, and sold the picture instantly. And suddenly he just said, you know what, this is the market that's out there, and so I'm going to become a paparazzi.
Since he's created this little empire, he is not the principal shooter. He has enlisted a cadre of immigrant labor, mostly all Brazilian men.
He achieved his dream of ubiquity, which is, I think, the dream of every paparazzi. It was his brainstorm that he could employ people who really didn't have any background in photography at all because digital cameras were so good. And he could sort of act as the brain for 60 or 70 guys who could be all over L.A. at once. And that way he would never miss a shot. When I first started researching the story, I decided to focus on this Brazilian team that covered Britney Spears, which over the course of the last 2 years has gotten all these memorable shots, you know, Britney with her head shaved, Brittany attacking the Jeep with her umbrella. And so I decided to focus on them. And so every day I'd go up to the top of Mulholland Drive where Brittany's house is, and I'd meet up with them, and I'd try to talk to them, and I'd say, so where are you from? My name is David. I'm doing a story about whatever. And then they'd say, she's out, she's out, she's out, she's out. And then they'd all run to their cars and leave me standing there with my notebook like an idiot. So what I then decided to do was to take a cab up to the top of Mulholland Drive and stand there in the hopes that after they left me standing by myself for about 3 or 4 days, they'd invite me to ride along with them out of pity. And that did work. And so, you know, that's how I reported my story.
And one of those who took pity on you was the photographer who apparently took the picture of Britney Spears shaving all her hair off. He told you that something happened on the day she shaved her head, something that made her seem different to the paparazzi who dogged her.
Well, she sort of was doing this dramatic thing. She was denuding herself of the normal trappings and protections of celebrity and saying, you know, look at me, I'm out of my mind. The number of paparazzi covering Britney literally after that day doubled, and then it doubled again. In a strange way, I got the sense of this as a relationship. They've both exploited her tragedy and served as a life net for her in that they've made it impossible for her craziness to go unnoticed.
It's so interesting. You illustrate this so beautifully in the piece, a very poignant scene where she apparently is about to drive into a retaining wall.
Yeah, this was Thanksgiving Day, and we followed Britney Spears to a record store, and I ran down with a number of the paparazzi to a parking garage where they thought she was going to exit. And she came out through a door, and her eyes were kind of rolling around. She kind of was walking towards the car and said, Happy Thanksgiving, and got into the car and then just drove straight for the wall. And all the paparazzi at that moment just put their cameras down. You can see they were like, no, 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 you know, and started directing her out of the parking garage. And once she was, you know, the car was properly aligned and it was heading towards the gate, then they all picked up their cameras again and started shooting. And then she like let them shoot her for 4 seconds, and then they chased her back up the hill. They are, in a sense, the substitute for family or friends or whatever it is. And it's no accident that she ended up now dating one of the photographers that I met.
A cynical person might say that parasites don't survive if their host doesn't survive.
That's true. But that job is a very, very hard job. And they are providing a news product that consumers want. The idea that the paparazzi are responsible for the tenor of coverage of Britney Spears or the fact that all these photographs are out there is clearly absurd.
Is it just me, or does the coverage of the New York governor remind you a little of Britney shaving her head?
Yeah, it does, in the sense that he is a person who in one moment has sort of been transformed into his opposite. And it's a good lesson to beware of the packaging of public figures, whether they're politicians or pop stars. And in a way, I think that paparazzi coverage is a good thing. If Elliot Spitzer was subject to this kind of coverage, we probably wouldn't be so surprised that he was hanging out in the Mayflower Hotel.
Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
David Samuels is a reporter. His collection of work titled Only Love Can Break Your Heart will be out next week by The New Press.
The HBO series The Wire ended last weekend. Its audience was small, even by HBO standards, but its devout following picked apart every detail over the 5 seasons in the belief that it was one of the most important shows on television. It was created by David Simon, a former reporter at the Baltimore Sun, and Ed Burns, a former Baltimore detective and inner-city schoolteacher. Together, they brought a level of realism to what was equal parts entertainment and critique of urban America. The series began its first season as a crime drama set in Baltimore, with a sophisticated portrayal of the police department and of a drug organization, as in this scene, which feels like a lesson in real-life police procedure.
Non-pertinent. How do you log that non-pertinent?
No drug talk.
They use codes to hide the patron phone numbers. And when someone does use a phone, they don't use names. And if someone does use a name, he's reminded not to. All of that is valuable evidence.
Of what?
Conspiracy. We're building something here, Detective. We're building it from scratch. All the pieces matter.
And all the pieces of Baltimore mattered to The Wire's creators. So later seasons anatomized labor unions, City Hall, public education, and finally, in its last season, the city newspaper. OTM's Mark Phillips has gone just a week without his favorite show, and he's already in withdrawal.
There are basically two categories of people, those who love The Wire and those who've been admonished for not watching it. If by some miracle you don't fit into either category, you do now. I'm telling you, you have to watch The Wire. It was called the greatest show on television ever for the past five seasons by almost everyone who's anyone in the media.
The interesting thing is that it's not only critics who love it, it's that journalists love it inordinately.
Jeffrey Goldberg is national correspondent for The Atlantic. He also participated in a back-and-forth conversation about The Wire for Slate's TV Club.
And I think people in our profession love it because it's about a subject that we care a great deal about, which is life in urban America. So here you have this very intelligent show that's grappling with these questions that many reporters have grappled with at different parts of their careers. And so it's like seeing the newspaper on TV sometimes.
Or a novel. Or a sociological study. There have been a lot of analogies. It's the kind of thing Wire creator David Simon tried to do as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun for 12 years, depict the city in all its complexity as an emblem for what ails urban America. But in 1994, as the Baltimore Sun was downsizing, Simon took a buyout with dozens of other journalists and left the newspaper world.
I felt I was being discouraged from looking outside whatever the given small box, small trick of the preconceived story was. And at that point, I had to look at it and say, you know what? It's, you know, nobody in this business is thinking big, man.
The Wire provided a way for Simon to think big. Instead of a simple battle of good versus evil, it's a crime drama that gives us extremely human characters, chewed up over five seasons by various institutions, in whose teeth it seems impossible to both succeed and do the right thing. This is perhaps clearest in the fourth season, the critics' favorite, when the school system lets down smart, good kids who really want to do right.
I still have a lot of kids who can barely handle whole numbers.
Look, you don't teach math. You teach the test. North Avenue is all about the leave no child behind stuff, getting spoon-fed.
And what do they learn?
Preparing for standardized tests cuts off the small but meaningful progress a cop-turned-school teacher has made with his students. It's an argument against No Child Left Behind, standardized tests, and poor funding, but it also points to a problem more profound.
You can tell the days by their faces. The best day is Wednesday. That's the farthest they get from home, from whatever's going on in the streets. You see smiles then. Monday is angry. Tuesdays, they're caught between Monday and Wednesday, so it could go either way. Thursdays, they're feeling that weekend coming. Friday is bad again.
Simon used the final season to show the media's role in Baltimore's malaise and created a fictional newspaper called the Baltimore Sun. The paper is considering a series on how public education is failing the children of Baltimore. But city editor Gus, a stand-in for David Simon, is frustrated with the narrow vision of his boss.
You want to look at who these kids really are, you got to look at the parenting or lack of it in the city. The drug culture, the economics of these neighborhoods. I mean, it's like you're up on a corner of a roof and you're showing some people how a couple of shingles came loose. And meanwhile, a hurricane wrecked the rest of the damn house.
Look, Gus, what I want to look at is the tangible, where the problem and solution can be measured clearly. I don't want some amorphous series detailing society's ills. If you leave everything in, soon you've got nothing.
David Simon.
What he's saying is we want some waifs who have been cruelly misused by a indifferent and venal school system. And what Gus was saying was what's happening to children in the city is more profound than that, and we're not getting our heads around it because we are trying to bite off what we think we can win a prize with.
And by prize, he means Pulitzer.
What is the currency by which newspapers and newspapermen are judged? I would say the Pulitzers are the ultimate currency. And if you present ideas that in their complexity do not lead themselves to a gotcha, you are not going to serve the interests of a prize culture.
I think there's nothing at all wrong with wanting to get recognition for great work.
Journalism professor Tony Barbieri worked 34 years at the Real Life Baltimore Sun.
especially if you're a regional newspaper that's doing great work and you want people to know about it, and along the way, call attention to the problems that you're writing about. But as far as it being a corrupting influence, it's like anything else. If you let it corrupt you, it can.
And according to the fifth and last season of The Wire, it does. At the center of David Simon's Baltimore Sun is Scott Templeton, a reporter whose ambition leads to a habit of making up quotes and eventually whole stories. In this scene, he's challenged by city editor Gus, who's overruled by the prize-hungry boss.
I mean, I'm not saying that this kid isn't everything you say he is, but Scott, damn, as an editor, I need a little more to go on if I'm gonna fly this thing.
I resent the implication.
I'm not implying anything. I'm on your side. But the standard for us has to be...
Scott, just finished your story. Good read. I'm putting it out front. I think you really captured the disparity of the two worlds in the city in a highly readable narrative. I wouldn't change a word.
As the tale of the lying journalist unfolds, it's hard not to see the Baltimore Sun plotline as a way for David Simon to settle scores with former colleagues. He's publicly blasted his former editors at the Sun, both of whom are well-respected, not just by the Pulitzer Prize Committee, but by the journalist community at large. Yes, detectives, union bosses, lawyers, and politicians all lie throughout The Wire, but usually for what they believe is the greater good. The lying journalist character is inspired by nothing but ambition. Critics say it lacked the subtlety and depth that they had come to expect from David Simon's characters. Jeffrey Goldberg.
What he did with the schools, we were expecting to do with journalism. And when he decided to focus on a serial fabricator rather than some of the, let's say, deeper, more systemic issues, or some of the issues that honest reporters face every day, that was disappointing.
Disappointing and distracting. Isn't a character reminiscent of Jason Blair a red herring for the problems that really ailed the American newspaper? For instance, electronic media and budget cuts?
What's happening with the internet and what's happening with newspapers is the economic preamble to the story that we portrayed in The Wire.
David Simon.
What we're interested in is not the mechanics of what's gone wrong. What we're trying to say is, given that preamble, how are people behaving?
It's hard to believe that journalists are responding to the threat of the internet by making things up. But Simon insists the problem is widespread and that the Sun had its own fabricator when he was there. But when critics focus on the lying journalist in the fifth season of The Wire, Simon says they've missed his real media critique.
In every episode, what's being depicted is a newspaper that's actually not connecting with the problems that exist on the ground. It's not noticing that the police department has been cheating stats for years and making crime go away. It's not noticing that the third grade test scores are being hyped so that No Child Left Behind is not exposed for what it is. That's the critique. And very tellingly, almost perfectly, I think with the exception of maybe one or two guys out there, everybody missed it.
Jeffrey Goldberg is one of those one or two guys who didn't miss it.
And I think that's a kind of profound statement about the limits of journalism. What they're saying to us is that most of the things that happen, we don't know. And even the people who are supposed to know the most, namely reporters, don't know very much at all. And that's a very interesting insight.
Perhaps, but pretty obvious to anyone who watched the first four seasons of the show. The Wire was fiction, but it was loved precisely because it offered viewers, including journalists, a weekly dose of reality that felt truer than much of the news. I think there still is a place in newspapers for reporters to get to the heart of complex issues, and that David Simon is overly pessimistic about the state of journalism. But if he's right, maybe the consolation will be more great TV series by ex-reporters, specifically at 9 o'clock on Sundays? Because I don't really have anything to do then anymore. For On the Media, I'm Mark Phillips.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon. Walk the straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. You gotta keep the devil way down in the hole.
That's it for this show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Fuolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaacs and Zachary Marsh. We also had help from Andy Lancet, Nadia Zonis, and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting Puccini's Madame Butterfly as performed by the New York City Opera on Thursday, March 20th, hosted by Susan Graham. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings. Support for On the Media is also provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.